Hi there, it's Melvin. Just wanted to take a moment to thank the team over at Thrizer for supporting this month's podcast sessions. Thrizer is a payment platform that you have to check out if you are a private pay therapist and accepting out-of-network benefits. It basically helps clients save on therapy upfront. Thrizer can help verify a client's out-of-network benefit ahead of the first session so that they get transparency up front on what their out-of-pocket costs will be. I'll tell you more about Thrizer here in the middle of our session, but if you go to sellingthecouch.com/Thrizer, you actually and then enter the code STC upon sign up, you get your first $2,500 in fees waived. Again, that's over at sellingthecouch.com/Thrizer, and be sure to enter the promo code STC. So we'll jump right into today's podcast session. Hi there, welcome to today's session of Selling the Couch. I hope you're doing well, having a fantastic day. So today's podcast session is a topic that I know a lot of us are thinking about, which is hosting a retreat. But I also know that a lot of us have fears about hosting that retreat, whether it's the logistical things or kind of a practical thing of, is this thing going to fill up? Or what if I put down some money down and what if it doesn't fill up and then the venue ends up taking the money that I had put down and I'm not able to get a refund on it. I am joined by Megan Gunnell. Megan is a clinical social worker by training. Her website is over at thrivingwellinstitute.com. And Megan has hosted a number of retreats since 2012. Literally started with a retreat that was happening at a community center, and Megan plays the harp, and so there was some harp music involved and all of these things, and then it evolved into a weekend retreat, and now Megan does international retreats as well. So she has done international retreats in Costa Rica, in Italy, and in France, among other places. And today's podcast conversation, I basically titled it Low Risk Ways to Host Your First Retreat. We're going to cover a number of different things. The first one, an area we start out with, is why is it so appealing for a therapist to consider a retreat? And then we jump into this idea of a fear that I know many of us have as we are thinking about retreats, which is how do we de-risk hosting a retreat, i.e., many of these venues require a down payment or a deposit in order to secure that venue. But what if your retreat doesn't fill up, or in the early stages of having to put that deposit down, likely it has not meant you don't have enough signups quite yet to meet often that deposit. So how do you sort of navigate that and reduce risk? And then we talk a little bit more into how to find venues that offer a 100% fully refundable option as well. And so how do you find those properties? Where do you look? What things should you be considering? We also get a lot into kind of the legal and the logistical stuff that like will kind of blow your mind. For example, like how far you actually need to plan these retreats. I was actually very surprised by this answer, and I think it's going to be really interesting. And then we wrap up with talking about retreat marketing. I feel like as with most things that have tremendous potential, and even down to one-on-one work, if you're doing therapy work, retreat marketing is such a vital part of it. And so how do you market a retreat? What has Megan learned in now hosting retreats for the past 12 plus years and working now with hundreds of therapists to host and coaching them through retreats as well? Megan also has an awesome Facebook group called the Thriving Therapist Group. It's around 20,000 members. So if you are definitely interested in all of this stuff, definitely encourage you to check that out. But we'll jump right into today's conversation. Here is my conversation with Megan Gunnell from thrivingwellinstitute.com. Hey, Megan, welcome to Selling the Couch.
Thank you so much, Melvin. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh my gosh, you know, we were talking about this right before. Crazy it's taken this long for you to come on the podcast. So of sincere apologies. But first of all, you are doing such amazing work in the world. And I feel like I really look forward to your like Facebook updates, especially like the cookie related ones.
Oh my gosh, thank you. That's so nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know for you, but like, you know, when I was undergrad and grad school, this is not a career that I envisioned, and even sort of the paths. And I do feel like in many ways, like, what a time to be alive that we get to do this and just, I don't know, like, use our skill set in just such atypical ways. So
it is amazing, isn't it? I feel really grateful. And sometimes I wake up and think, what happened? I was, you know, for so long just focused on building a solo private practice. And I was so, you know, focused on that goal and so happy with my, you know, world that I had created. And it seems like overnight, I mean, even though it's been about 4 or 5 years now, that things have really shifted for me. I just feel like, who am I now? And what am I doing? And how did I get here? I don't know sometimes, you know, how it all unfolded. It's just such a weird and strange and wonderful place to be. But I do feel super grateful to host the community that I host, the Thriving Therapist Group, and to be able to hopefully inspire other therapists to sort of think outside the box and sort of build and scale their business to the point where they feel like they're thriving in their personal and professional lives too.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're doing, like, I think the cool thing is you've done the work, you've shown us how to do it, and then you're helping other therapists and our colleagues do this. And I don't know for you, but like, I had an old supervisor that once told me, Mel, you have to see what we're doing as a skill set beyond just like clinical work. And I guess maybe before we jump into the world of retreats, how did you make that shift from, you know, I am a licensed clinician and the things that I can do in private practice is therapy, to I can do retreats, or, you know, like, even expand beyond that? Like, tell us a little bit about the internal work that it took to make that shift.
Well, I always start this kind of question with this story about buying a book when I was a freshman in college in 1992, back in the horse and buggy days. And it was called Healing in the Mind by Bill Moyers. I have it on my shelf. And the last chapter of that book was an interview with Dr. Rachel Naomi Raymond, who is an oncologist and a retreat leader, a writer, a speaker. She's just this amazing, inspirational oncologist out on the Pacific Coast in California, who has written a lot of books herself, but she was interviewed by Bill Moyers. And in the very last chapter of that book, I was fascinated with mind-body, you know, sort of connection. So I bought this book and I just devoured it. And she talked in the last chapter all about building retreats for cancer patients out on the coast of California. And they talked about yoga and nutrition and Santre and like all these really cool things that they were incorporating. And it's like my mind and body just exploded with excitement because I was like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do one day. I'm going to be a retreat leader. And then fast forward through my bachelor's degree and some of my work in hospitals, I was a music therapist. So I played the harp at the bedside with the patients that I was working with. And I worked with a team of really cool people. I worked with art therapists who were doing mask work and mandala work and, you know, cool guided imagery therapists that were offering guided imagery scripts for cancer patients. And I worked with aromatherapy and drama and dance therapists. And I just did all this really fun, cool, creative stuff in the hospital settings for many years until I got to the point where I thought, this is it. I have to take my work deeper. And I wanted to pivot away from hospital work. And really, I saw myself doing, you know, outpatient psychotherapy. So I got my MSW. And then after I started my private practice, I kept hearing the call. And so I love to help therapists start by listening to the audience in front of them. And it's so important that we do that, because I would imagine anyone who's listening to this right now can probably identify a few clients who might not outwardly be asking you for something, but they are indirectly asking you for something. And so I had a lot of busy working moms that were in my private practice that were really stressed to the max, that were always giving outward and never really taking back for themselves. And they kept saying to me, what I wouldn't give for a day for myself, like what I wouldn't give to just have one day just for me. And I was like, oh my gosh, they're all asking me to build a one-day retreat. And so from there, I just took off with it. I built a one-day retreat model that led to weekend retreats and groups and support groups and wellness groups. And then I moved from the weekend model to the week-long international Costa Rica retreats. And the first one we launched was 2012. So from there, I've been doing it ever since. And I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, thank you so much for sharing that part of the journey. I think that's also highlighted for me is you didn't start by trying to do like Costa Rica retreats, right? Like, right. And I think a lot of clinicians, at least for me, I can speak for myself, which is any sort of new venture, my natural default is to end and think about like the final product. And I'm like nowhere near the final product. But by thinking about the final product, I get crippled into actually taking the first little step.
Right. That happens all the time because I think it's easy to look on Instagram or any Facebook feed or TikTok and see these glossy, amazing, perfect images of these transformative retreats that people are hosting that do actually happen in reality. But what they're not seeing is the climb to get to the top of that mountain. And I worry that a lot of people feel like they might be, you know, getting some imposter syndrome, or they might feel like a failure because they see that and think, I can't do that. How could I get there? But I started in a community center hosting a one-day program with a little luncheon and a cool little art experiential, some harp music meditation thing that I did and some self-care kind of workshop and a nice little lunch and a yoga class. And it was like one and done. And people loved it. And then they were like, can you host a weekend in Northern Michigan for us? Why don't we do this as a real weekend retreat? So it started to grow, but I did many, many little things before I got to a big thing. And I think, you know, that's the other piece of this is to really think about starting small and to know that those small steps make a huge impact for people. Because many of those women who attended those one-day workshops that I was hosting or one-day retreats, they could also not have taken a week off and flown to another country and left their families, like, you know, and or afforded to do that, you know, kind of a large investment at that time. And so it was like together we were all kind of growing in the baby step to bigger step kind of commitment.
Yeah. And then I think like it reminds me of that Kevin Kelly's article, 1,000 True Fans, right? And those initial folks, even though when you're starting that retreat or that first thing at a community center, right? You are like, gosh, this is not where I want to be, like in terms of like the big goal. But people remember that and people remember the courage, people remember the experience. And I think in many ways, actually having something that's not like hyper-produced and almost has a human clunky feel to it, I think it just builds super fans and it builds trust and all of those things. And yeah. So thank you for even outlining that. One, you know, one question that I had for you was, I do feel like a lot of clinicians want to start retreats. Maybe this is a silly question, but what is so appealing about creating a retreat? I mean, it seems like a ton of time invested to create these times, tons of logistical stuff you got to figure out. Like, you know, like even for that first one, it sounds like a yoga person coming in, like a lot of stuff you got to almost be like.
Lots of details.
Yeah, and a lot of event planning. And even I feel like for a lot of clinicians are probably don't default to like super detail oriented, right? So, but what is that appeal of a retreat?
I think people, especially clinicians that build their entire business on an hour by hour basis, you know, when we see a client 1 hour at a time, we're craving something deeper. Our clients are craving something deeper, and we're looking for that transformative shift. And I can say without a doubt that that happens on retreat. And that can happen in a one-day retreat model or in a small weekend retreat model, and definitely in an international one-week or longer retreat experience. And I think clinicians are really looking for that. And I think that, you know, it's difficult when we just do 1 hour at a time to sort of like see this grand transformation and to carry a group of people through something, you know, like I'm thinking back to all the retreats I was leading in Costa Rica, for example. Those are, I cannot emphasize enough how much mind, body, and spirit are connected when you're on retreat, and also how you watch people really transform when you pull them away from their everyday life experiences. Because when do we have the chance to do that? You know, when we go on retreat, we're actually inviting people to come into a space where they get to reconnect with who they are. They get to reinvigorate their passion and purpose. They get to redefine you know, who they are and where they're going. These are major, major life questions that people are seeking to answer. And so who better to do that than a psychotherapist?
Yeah, so well said. And I think there are a couple of things. One is, I think for many clinicians, the default is trading time for income, one-to-one work, right? And I think it definitely takes, I don't know, for me, it's been such a transformative experience. And even as I now, you know, go back into a tiny private practice, I'm like keenly aware of like, wow, like I've come from this model of one-to-one, gone to like more scalable offers. And now like coming back, I feel like so much more keenly aware of that like trading time for income thing. And it's really, I don't know, like if you're listening and you have not experienced it, I think once you go to the beyond trading time for income model, it's so liberating. And I think the real benefit for me, and maybe I know for you as well, like we really get to practice like self-care, and we get to practice that thing we preach. And that's really hard, because I was talking with a friend recently, and I think they're like probably in their seventh, eighth year of like private practice, right? And when you've done that, like only see one-to-one clients for, and you got to do this year after year after year to build your income and bring in income, it's very hard, I feel like, from a mental health and from a resilience. Like I know like all of us are very resilient, but from a, it's a different ball game when it's like 1 to 2 years in your private practice, you've got that great energy and one, but then it's like when you get like 10, 12 years in and you realize this is the only model, like it's difficult. What do you think? Like, I mean, I know, yeah, just kind of love to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. I felt like I was just starting a marathon when I was starting my private practice, and I was just out of the gates running and really excited. And, you know, I could see everybody running with me, and I was like, we're doing this, you know. And then I think a few years, like 10, 15, you know, almost 20 years into it, you just get to this point where it's like, oh my gosh, I still care deeply about each individual client, each story. I have a lot of compassion for, a lot of empathy, but the cumulative effect of holding space that intense for that long, for that many clients, like we're talking thousands of cases, you know, that we work with over the course of a decade or more, is really difficult for the clinician. You're right. And it's an isolating field. For me, I love travel. I would rather invest in travel than any material thing. So I'm not the kind of gal that puts money into a fancy car or special fancy purses. I would rather put my money into an experience. And so for me, it was just easy to combine my passion for travel and what travel brings to me and opens my eyes up to a larger worldview and gets me out of my own sort of head and helps me think outside the box and get creative and think of different solutions. And it humbles me. It like brings me a ton of gratitude. And I was like, what a better way, you know, to combine sort of my interest in travel with work, you know, because I thought, I would love to be able to, my first retreat I did in Costa Rica, I remember thinking to myself, I'd be so happy if I could just break even, because I could go to Costa Rica and stay in this fabulous retreat, exclusive retreat center, overlooking the Pacific Ocean with this gorgeous open air yoga deck. And I could host this really cool transformative thing, and I could do it, and I could travel there, and all my expenses would be paid. And I was like, so happy that we did it. My colleague and I ran those together in the beginning. And when we left, we were like, not even sure in the budget if we were going to have any money to profit from this experience. And thankfully we did. I remember feeling so excited when I found out, like once we reconciled everything, that we had a little profit there. But then the following year, I was like, okay, let's get serious. Like, now I know I can do this. Now I know what I'm hosting. And I also do want to make it profitable for me, because it's like a 10-month project. So that's another thing I want your listeners to know, is this is not just the 1 week that you're hosting your event, you know, internationally, or even the weekend that you're doing it. You're giving up a weekend to host something locally, or, you know, at an Airbnb in the US, for example. You're planning this thing most likely for 6 to 12 months. So even this morning, for example, I'll tell you, I was looking at retreat venues in Italy for 2025, in the fall of 2025. So I am already working like that far in advance. You know, I have a 2-year calendar on my wall that shows me how far I have to book things, you know, so that I can be that far ahead to secure venues that are, you know, perfect venues that are large enough for the community that I want to host and that are affordable for me. But it takes a lot of forethought. So you brought up another great point about event planning and detail orientation. So if that's not your strength, it doesn't mean you can't host a retreat. It just means you might need to outsource or partner with someone who is more of a planning kind of detail-oriented person. So you can certainly host an amazing retreat and have some incredible content that you provide as a therapist, but you could have someone else do some of the little sort of nuts and bolts and travel arrangements and venue selection and securement and, like, you know, reviewing contracts. And there's a lot of details that goes into hosting a retreat successfully and safely. I'll say that.
The safely part, what, just from a legal or like what?
Legal, financial, you know, in terms of liability coverage, disclaimers, protecting your license, framing it the correct way, making sure everyone has the right, you know, details for emergency contacts. I will say, on the sort of darker side of hosting retreats, sometimes guests will get sick or injured. Things have happened. You know, on my retreat experiences, I've hosted many, many retreats over the last 20 years. And on occasion, something will occur. Somebody will be really sick, or somebody, I had one client have, you know, who had to be hospitalized. And so there was a lot of management in terms of their emergency contacts. There's allergies to consider. There's medications. I had a client arrive to a retreat without thyroid medication one time, and I was like, oh my God, like, we're in the jungle. So it was really difficult to try to manage some of that stuff on the ground. We did manage it, but it was very difficult. And so that said, you know, you do want to protect yourself financially, legally, and otherwise. And when you're booking these kinds of things, you also have to think about, you know, your due diligence in terms of protecting the investment. Now, you know, there are a lot of people out there hosting retreats, and, you know, there are a lot of people who do things very differently than I do. But I'll tell you from experience, I have multiple different savings accounts. I just want to kind of throw some of these little details at your audience, because I don't think people think about this. But when you're hosting more than one event, you're going to need a savings account or some sort of money market, depending on how long, you know, your timeline is for hosting something, where you're holding that money sort of in an escrow until your event happens. Because God forbid, you're going to do what I did, which is we've booked and sold out two culinary tours. So my husband and I also run culinary tours, which are sort of like a retreat, but for cooking classes and culinary and foodie type guests. He's a chef. And so I handle the details and the venue and sort of planning the winery excursions and market tours, and he does the cooking part.
Before we jump into the rest of today's session, if you have launched a successful private practice and are now looking at launching an online course, just wanted to encourage you to download the free SDC Online Course Creator Kit. That's over at sellingthecouch.com/course-kit. This is basically a 7-part email course. We broke it down into very simple and easy to understand language, but it's the exact exercises that we use for our mastermind members in order to validate your course idea. So you'll basically take your idea for your online course and run it through a bunch of different exercises that we use in order to make sure that it's a profitable one. Again, that's over at sellingthecouch.com/course-kit. So we'll jump right back in.
But we planned two and sold out two international culinary tours right before the pandemic. And we had the venue secured. We had them both sold out, one in France, one in Italy. We had flights booked. Everything was done. And it was, the first one was supposed to be hosted in April of 2020. And of course, with the travel ban happening, we had to tear down both, not only the first one in spring, but we tore down the fall one as well, because the pandemic was still, you know, really horrible at that time. So thank God we had saved, you know, all the money that, you know, people have invested in us for these experiences, and we were able to provide refunds. But that stuff has to be spelled out in your cancellation policy. You have to talk about force majeure, you know, what happens when there's a war or, you know, a pandemic or a travel ban. You know, how do you refund people? How much of that will you be able to refund to them? What if you don't get the money back from your venue? I mean, there's a lot of pieces here that I think people should think through. And, you know, you want to be super careful with how you do that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for highlighting those, because I feel like in many of these situations, like, people accentuate the positives. And I think there are some wonderful, like, positives and wonderful upside to it, right? But as with any, like, new venture, right, there are things to consider. I mean, you know, like, I work with colleagues creating their first course, and a lot of therapists want to create courses, but the reality is there's a lot of legal stuff that we have to consider, right? And if we don't talk about that, like, it creates this false sense of thing, because then, I mean, I like you and I, we would feel horrible if somebody did something and then like there ended up being liability or something like that, right? That they didn't anticipate, or, you know, we didn't mention it to them. So, Megan, thank you for doing that. I know that in planning these retreats, a lot of therapists get really worried about booking a venue. Like you mentioned it earlier, like you had venues booked, but then they're also worried, okay, if I go and spend, and I don't know anything about this, so maybe just even enlighten me. Like, I would think you would need to put some sort of deposit down, right? And what happens in a scenario where the clinician puts, they're worried about having to put this down payment down, but then they also don't have the security of knowing whether it's going to sell out or not. Like, can we like talk, I guess, through some safe ways to do this so that, you know, it can mitigate risk a little bit?
Absolutely. I always recommend when you're just starting out, first of all, start small. So just test your audience with a one-day program, you know, rent a small community center or some sort of, you know, hotel room or a venue that you can host a nice small group in for a full day program and just see how it goes. Test your audience, test yourself, like make sure you think of everything, your details. And, you know, there's all kinds of little things that will come up along the way. As you do it, you'll start to learn, like, oh, I would do this differently next time. Or, you know, I would probably remember to have this, you know, structured this way. Then, when you're thinking about hosting like a weekend retreat or, you know, something longer, I always tell people search for a venue that will offer you 100% refund up to a certain date. And then make sure that you give yourself a long enough runway so that you can try to sell the minimum number of slots you need in order to financially make that viable. And then from there, if you know you can break even and you hit your 100% cancellation date and you still have a few slots to sell, then you can, you know, successfully and confidently move forward and hold that venue and not feel like, you know, you can't afford to do it. But it's tricky because some of the venues, even resorts that I've hosted at, they don't offer 100% refund. So sometimes you have to be willing to lose your deposit if you can't, you know, sell your slots. Another thing to consider on this same topic is the size of your platform. So I'm confident knowing that if I'm trying to sell, for example, a minimum of 100 spaces for a Thrive Summit in Costa Rica that I'm hosting, for example, with CEs and speakers, and it's more like a conference style retreat and summit. I know that I can sell 100 slots because I have 20,000 people in my community. But if when I first started out, I was only looking at hosting retreats and workshops for my caseload of clients. And so, you know, I was looking at maybe 150 or 200 clients on my caseload, and I was trying to get 10 people, you know, to fill those retreats. So you have to do a little bit of math. You have to also sort of ask your audience. There's nothing wrong with asking a few people in your community, whether it's your clients or the therapist that you're doing coaching with, for example, or whatever it might be. To say, hey, I'm thinking of hosting a retreat next year in this location or in this region. And this is what I think the retreat will include. What do you guys think? And kind of give a little bit of a beta test to that to say, does anybody feel like they're interested in this? Do I have a warm enough audience to do it? So that might help with some security and confidence for therapists that are just thinking about getting started.
Yeah, I love that because I think a lot of times, again, I fall into this, which is instead of I almost like try to build in stealth or something, right? Versus, but I think there is something, each of those little like validation steps, and especially just coming from a place of like, I'm thinking about, so it's like not a certain thing. I think it just, one, I think it gives you feedback. And then, especially if the feedback is positive, it gives you momentum. I think then that's probably equally important in all of it. You said two things, and I wanted to dive a little deeper into them. Man, our time is flying, by the way. Like, I feel like we could probably talk like another, but we'll probably have to go a little bit over, but these are such a good conversation. So you said break even versus having a little profit. So when you get to that deadline and you're, why do you think about break even versus like being like a little profitable? Like,
well, in the very beginning, like I said, I was just so happy to host something internationally in Costa Rica that I was willing to break even. And by that, I mean, bring a photographer so that you are paying for your photographer's flight, lodging, and her work or his work to take photographs, you know, during your retreat experience so that you can easily sell the next one. So I knew I wanted to do that at the very first Costa Rica retreat. And to be honest, I'm still using images from 2012 on my, you know, retreat website pages and things because they were so good and they still stand true today to what I host down there. But every time I travel, I do bring a professional photographer with me now so that I can capture, you know, what we're doing and the essence and feeling of what's going on. But I do want people to also think about making this a profitable venture. And you can do that. It's just a matter of knowing the formula. So you have to think about the cost of your venue, the price of what you want to make, your price tag for your retreat experience, and you have to cover a lot of expenses. You have to cover your flight and your, you know, lodging, of course, and then your team member, if you're bringing a team member with you or a partner that you're doing this with, which I recommend for the first couple times because it's a lot to manage. And then you have to cover all of the expenses for your guests while you're on site, whether that's excursions or yoga or whatever other activities you're building in, all of their food, you know, for their retreat experience. And you can decide how you want to do that. You know, some people host retreats at a resort where the ticket for the hotel, the price for the hotel might include meals, but you have to kind of figure that all out and do a lot of math. And then you have to buffer that budget because there's going to be a lot of expenses that you're not thinking about. There's been a few times when I've hosted internationally, like in Italy, for example, with the culinary tours. And I think I know what the budget is, but then when we're checking out, I'm like, oh, we have to pay for water, like water use or whatever. There's like these little things that they're like, oh yeah, you heated the pool the whole time you were here. I mean, and those things are in the fine print in your contract, which sometimes we know when you're moving really quickly, it's easy to miss some of those details. And I've been caught off guard a few times by some extra charges at the end, or if something gets broken and you don't get your security deposit back. So you want to buffer all that and still make sure that you are leaving with a generous profit margin because, again, it's not just the week that you're there. For me, this is like a 10 to 12 month investment of time and marketing and, you know, trying to fill it, trying to plan it, like coordinating all the details. So you really want to cover your salary, essentially, you know, for 10 months of work too.
Yeah, really, really awesome point. Two questions. So what's like a general like buffer, like is like a percentage that you would recommend? So that's like one. And then I forgot the second one is, but I'll come back to it. Well, maybe we'll start with there.
Well, people ask me that a lot. I have a couple courses on retreat building. So I kind of go through like a formula of all the different kinds of expenses you have to think about adding in when you're, you know, creating a price point. I will tell you, I try to tell people, add up all your expenses and then divide by the number of your ideal participants. So you might have, you know, I don't know, $50,000 in expenses and you have 10 people coming and you want to, you know, divide the number of people into your expenses and you buffer those expenses. Probably by, it depends. It depends how big your venue is. It depends how large your group is. It depends where you're hosting it, how long. I mean, I always put a generous buffer in there when I'm hosting an event for 100 people versus when I'm hosting an event for 10 at a smaller venue. So you do want to have a nice cushion there for yourselves. And then you divide by that number to try to get the break-even cost. And then you double that rate for the registration price so that you know you have, you know, a good amount for yourself and your team and your marketing efforts. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. I pay a business manager to manage all the spreadsheet data and all the coordination with the clients. And like, I have a VA that does the graphics and Canva and promos and marketing strategy. So there's like a launch campaign kind of all behind these retreats too that I'm paying for. So you have to think of some of those pieces when you're doing the math on what to charge people. Then you want to really look at it and say, is this a price point that feels right for my audience? You know, is this intuitively a yes? I always ask people to sort of check in head, heart, and gut. Like, does this feel aligned with how much you think this retreat value is and how much it should be charged, how much the people should pay for it? But also, will you make a profit? So it's a really delicate balance because some venues that you look at, for example, are super beautiful, but they're super expensive. And so I've had a lot of coaching calls with therapists that want to build retreats, and they come to me with these amazing venues and I'm like drooling over the pictures with them, but I'm like, wait, pump the brakes. Like, let's take a closer look. You would have to charge an astronomical fee, you know, for your participants to come in order for you to break even or to make a profit. So let's take a closer look at all your other options.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I want to be super mindful of your time. Is it okay if we take about 5 more minutes?
Sure, I'm fine.
Okay. You shared that there are 100% like fully refundable properties. How do you find those?
Well, they are on Airbnb. I have rented some before. It depends on the size and where you're hosting and how big they are. But some of them do allow a 100% refund up to a certain point. So it might be like, I don't know, 90 to 120 days before you're going to be there. And then they have like a 50% refund up to this point and then no refund up to this point. So you have to look at those cancellation policies really carefully. But remember, hosting in the United States is very expensive. And, you know, when I host experiences, I not only love to bring people abroad, and I love hosting in Costa Rica for lots of reasons, or hosting in Europe for lots of reasons, but the venues are also more affordable because there's more of them. So these places like Italy or France or places where I've hosted in Costa Rica, they have these amazing, you know, retreat centers or houses that are sort of designed for retreats. And they're ready to accept people to book those properties. And they're inviting people from all over the globe to host their events and, you know, at these venues. But in the US, it becomes very, very expensive for us to find a venue on Airbnb or VRBO, for example, that, you know, or even a retreat, you know, a hotel venue, a resort, for example. It becomes very, very expensive for therapists to look at hosting in the United States. So I do encourage people, even though it feels like a big leap to host abroad, to kind of look at properties across the globe, because you have to kind of calculate people's flights and time. And, like, you know, all of that has to be part of your calculation. Because, I mean, if you want to host something in, you know, Bora Bora, I don't know how many therapists could take enough time off to, you know, recover from the jet lag that it would take to get there, you know. And I mean, a lot of people do it, but it's like, for me, I love going up and down, like, you know, from the US to Costa Rica. It doesn't require a lot of jet lag, or the flights are pretty easy to find. But those things have to be part of your calculation too, for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. Great answer. Megan, kind of the final area that I wanted to talk about is marketing, because I think we started our conversation speaking about that. What are like the top two strategies that you've seen work when it comes to like marketing these retreats in order to fill them?
Well, one thing is you have to be very clear on your intentions when you build something. Why are you building it? Who are you building it for? And what is the result or the promise or solution that your clients or attendees will get by attending this retreat? So once you're clear on those three things, then the landing page really writes itself. And then the right people who are, you know, really wanting to be part of your retreat will resonate with your message around what it is, who it's for, and what they're going to get out of it. Because you have different themes. Sometimes retreats carry a theme. A grief and loss retreat would be very different from one that's all about, you know, couples work or whatever. So you really want to think about what it is that you're offering and who it's for, really drill down to that ideal client and really understand what your promise is before you, you know, build your marketing strategy. The second tip is really think about your runway, because if you don't give yourself a long enough runway, it'll be really hard to get that plane off the ground. So a lot of people will say to me, I've had a lot of therapists sign up for coaching calls and they're like, I'm building a retreat in 2 months and I don't have anyone booked yet. And I'm like, okay, it's too soon. So I'm like, let's take a look at maybe tearing that one down and then building one for next, you know, year or in 6 to 9 months from now, because you really do need a long runway for people to look at, you know, booking the time to do this and, you know, saving the money to invest in it, maybe making a payment plan for people. But I will tell you, one of the fastest strategies to selling out is, you know, making sure that you're building something that your audience in front of you is asking for, and then making sure that you give yourself a long enough runway, and also building up, you know, a little bit of a warm excitement around when you're going to open this registration. So you're talking about where you're hosting it. You're talking about what people might get out of the experience. You're talking about the excitement of being there and you know, all the different components of what makes this retreat so special. And then you keep saying, it's going to open, it's going to open, it's going to open. And when it opens, you do usually have a lot of people who have already seen it and looked at it and thought, wow, I really want to be part of that. And then when you open it, it sells very quickly. So hopefully that's the strategy that would help most people sell out.
Yeah, I love that. And I think the big thing I'm just taking away is like build this in layers and build this like block by block, right? Because even though it feels like, oh, I'm just doing like a half day retreat or a one day retreat, the reality is you're putting the blocks together and you're creating the systems so that when you do scale to, and if you want to scale to like the weekend or the international, just becomes like so much easier.
For sure. Start small, baby steps, and listen to the audience that's in front of you. And I think it's, you know, you do have to think about protecting yourself. There's lots of little details involved. But if you start in a really small way, it's easy to sort of scale it, you know, over time.
Yeah. Can I ask one final question?
Sure.
So let's say like, if you don't hit that number, right, that break-even number, what's the best way that you found to like communicate to people who signed up, like basically saying like, hey, we're not going to run it, you know, but let's say you've had like, I don't know, two people sign up or something and you really want need a 10 or something like that.
So it's difficult. I have had clients, coaching clients, you know, like I say, that didn't maybe have enough of lead time or something happened with the price point or, you know, other world events got in the way of what they were trying to build or host. And I think you have to be very clear and upfront. You have to talk about your refund policy or application of a deposit towards a future retreat, or that you're simply changing the dates. So sometimes people will say, they'll ask those two people that signed up, like, look, I still really want to do this, but I think we've, you know, booked it too soon. What works best for you? Can we push it back a little bit and check with your venue and see if you could, you know, reschedule it for 6 months from now? And see if you can still host it at that time and then give yourself a little longer runway. Sometimes people just want a clean refund and you'll just start over, but you do want to be clear and honest, you know, with your community and apologize, you know, for not being able to host it at that time. But sometimes things come up and people in this day and age, especially in a post-pandemic world, are used to cancellations and changes, and being flexible is, I think, part of that philosophy that I think everybody's feeling these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Megan, thank you again for doing this. I'm incredibly grateful for you. Please tell us a little bit more about the work that you're doing in the world and where we can learn more about it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's really my pleasure to talk about retreat building. It's one of my passions. You can certainly hop into the Thriving Therapist Facebook community, or you can find me at thrivingwellinstitute.com.
Perfect. Megan, thank you again and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much. You too.
Hey there, I hope that you enjoyed my conversation with Megan, and especially if hosting retreats is something that is in your future. I hope more than anything, it just this episode just gives you encouragement in order to think about that, and more importantly, just to move forward on it. I was thinking a lot about this conversation as I got ready to record this part of the podcast. And, you know, the one thing I kept thinking about is, well, two things. One is, you know, I shared a quote, I think probably in a few episodes ago, a quote that seems to be guiding a lot of how I make business decisions and life decisions recently, which is, I heard it from Ali Abdaal the first time, which is basically when you're starting something new, get going, then get good, then get smart. And I think a lot of therapists want to optimize for getting good and getting smart before they get going. And I think retreats are a prime example of this. I think so many of us, it's easy to go on Airbnb or VRBO and search for venues and almost like create nice, like color-coded documents and all of these things and do vision boards and all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, I think jumping into doing the actual work and trying to make it happen, I think is the best way to learn. But I think the thing I took away from this conversation with Megan is it doesn't have to be something grand scale, i.e. don't do an international like weekend or week-long retreat as your first kind of thing. Instead, like literally start with a half-day to one-day retreat, like at a local community center or gathering place or co-working space or any of these kind of places, and then just build out from there. Because that's the get going part, because the other side of it is you'll figure out, this is something I started doing recently with all of our, anytime we have launches for our online course mastermind, I literally sit down for like 2 hours. And at this point, I'm actually just kind of accumulating this data over as the stuff is happening. But basically, I take some time to say like, what worked well, what didn't work well, and what do we need to improve? And that way, when you're hosting your retreat at the community center, you're taking that same information so that when you start to scale, and if you want to scale, right, to like international retreat or something like that, you are taking all of the little pearls of wisdom and the hard-earned lessons so that when you do get to that international level, that your retreat can be truly awesome. The second thing that I took away from the conversation is just the how long these take to plan. So Megan alluded to, it takes about 24, year and a half to 24 months, to especially to plan these international retreats. So be sure to give yourself a long window, but by the same token, don't use it as a way to like compress and stress yourself out like in the last 6 months, but use it more as a way to intentionally build, because all of these things, right? The reality is they take time, but one thing I have had to really unlearn, and I don't think I'm like perfect at it, but sometimes like I create stress for myself just to like motivate myself to do well. And what I'm learning now at, you know, the ripe age of 41 is that, you know, that takes a toll on your health, and it's not like something that's healthy or sustainable, and it's not a good model for anybody. So give yourself lots of time, but also just do intentional and thoughtful work. I think just a real practical thing is even just blocking out time every week just to focus on retreat kind of stuff. Megan's website is again over at thrivingwellinstitute.com, and definitely be sure to join her Facebook community, which is over at The Thriving Therapist. If you just go on Facebook and look for Thriving Therapist, you should be able to find it as well. We'll also put it in the show notes for you. Have a great rest of your day, and I appreciate you so much for tuning in. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Selling the Couch podcast. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit www.sellingthecouch.com.
So if you've been listening to the STC podcast for a while, or you've been listening to podcasts and you've had this thought of, Mel, I would love to launch my own podcast in order to grow my business, just wanted to encourage you to check out our free podcasting workshop, which is over at sellingthecouch.com/podcasting workshop. You can basically sign up at a day and a time that works for you. It's 90 minutes. And when I do these workshops or when I record them, I truly believe in quality teaching, so it's going to be well worth your time. We're going to go through gear recommendations and how to launch strategically and how to think about monetizing your podcast and how to line up your podcast with your existing offers and how to do it strategically and authentically and not salesy and slimy and all of those things. So again, the link is over at sellingthecouch.com/podcasting workshop.